This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The civil rights movement in America started long before 1963 and continues long afterwards. Some would argue that it does, in fact, continue to this day. But today, August 28th, marks the 50th anniversary of a moment in the movement in which the tide began to turn, the moment in which those fighting for civil rights were able to articulate their vision for the future in a way in which those outside the movement not only began to understand what African Americans wanted, but to be persuaded that their call for justice was right. August 28th, 1963, was the day that hundreds of thousands of people converged on the Mall in Washington to demand those rights. Having grown up in the D.C. suburbs, I remember my parents expressing concern in hushed tones that whatever trouble might start in the district that day could cross the Potomac. But that never happened. The day was peaceful, a testimony to Dr. Martin Luther King's nonviolent approach to the demand for full inclusion into American society. And, of course, the day was capped off with Dr. King's remarkable I Have a Dream speech, which carefully, almost scripturally, delineated what America could become if the equality enshrined in our Declaration of Independence actually became the words by which we lived. On the Mall that day was charlatan Charles Jones, a former professor at Johnson C. Smith University, a successful attorney and an activist, largely responsible for the historic lunch counter sit-ins in our region in the 1960s. He joins us on this 50th anniversary morning. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, and good morning to you, kind sir.
Nice to have you here again. Jack Claiborne was a longtime editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer who covered civil rights in the 1960s, was in fact on the Mall 50 years ago with Charles Jones. Nice to have you back with us again as well.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
And Dr. Patrick Graham is president and CEO of the Urban League of the Central Carolinas. They have organized a day of opportunity on this 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. They will use this as a day to release a policy agenda in response to recent state and federal decisions affecting education, jobs, voting rights, and the justice system. Nice to have you here tonight. Today, rather.
Thank you for having me.
The event is tonight at 6 p.m. at the Park Ministry at 6029 Babies Ford Road.
That's right.
In my mind, and I don't know why this is, I have the I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington placed much further up in the 1960s, much later than 1963, but it was 1963. I don't know why I have that confused in my head. Let's start by talking about what that movement was like on that day in 1963 and prior to that. There had been peaceful demonstrations. There had been non-peaceful demonstrations elsewhere in the South by 1963. The non-peaceful part, not because of the demonstrators, but because of citizens and police. Dr. King had already been jailed in Birmingham. He had written the letters from Birmingham by 1963. What else had taken place prior to 1963 in the movement?
Charles had led the sit-ins in the Charlotte lunch counters. Freedom Riders had come through Charlotte and Rock Hill, South Carolina, and Birmingham, Alabama. There were street demonstrations in a great many cities across the South.
And I was blessed to have been on the Freedom Rides. I had met John Lewis when we formed in May of 1960, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mm-hmm. up in Raleigh. I'd also spent 30 days on a chain gang down in Rock Hill. We joined, a group of us from SNCC joined a group of the Friendship Nine who had been demonstrating all year in South Carolina, said, "You out of your mind. You think we're going to let you sit at the same table with us? We own you, boy." So we decided to come and join them, and literally, Sherrod and I spent 30 days on a York County chain gang. Mm-hmm. Was arrested on the Freedom Rides, May 26th. Sherrod and I decided to go to Albany, Georgia, to begin a full movement of every issue, including voter registration. So by the time 1963 came, when I was blessed to have gotten a scholarship to law school at Howard University, I had seen a lot of what moved the energy up to that moment. But when we finally got down, I was walking down from Howard and saw that sea as far as the eye could see and beyond everything the imagination could come up with. I said, oh, my gosh, maybe we have make this come to this moment.
Mm-hmm. So, and I'll tell you something else, too. I think that prior to this, there's also still a debate in these communities over whether nonviolence was the right way to go. I mean, right here up the road, right here in Monroe, you had people like Robert Williams leading the NAACP, but also with veterans fighting really with the use of self-defense against the Klan and others. And so I think that part of what you see occur at the March on Washington is sort of this affirmation that nonviolence may be the way to go. It is an ultimate victory in some sense at that moment for nonviolence, even though I would say it would be temporary. And folks like Robert Williams also had a place in the hearts of many of those community members.
There was no guarantee that that March on Washington was going to be nonviolent. In fact, according to the Washington Post, on that day, for the first time, this is a quote, for the first time since Prohibition, the city banned the sale of alcoholic beverages for the day, hospitals stockpiled plasma and canceled elective surgeries, the D.C. Firemen's Union didn't like it, but the city ordered 350 of its members to switch roles and take on police duty on the day of the march. D.C. police officers were banned from taking vacation. Other forces received riot control training. 30 Army helicopters patrolled the skies, swooping over the reflecting pool. 4,000 troops stood ready in the Washington suburbs, and 15,000 paratroopers were placed on standby in North Carolina. They were ready.
But during the march, you were unaware of that police presence. There were a lot of policemen and armed military people, but they did not. They were just sort of invisible. The crowd that gathered just seemed to overwhelm them, and people looking on. I was there and remembered what an apprehension there was in Washington about this, and yet that apprehension just faded away almost immediately that morning. By 10:30 that morning, the numbers of people who had come were enormous, and the police presence was just you were unaware of them.
How do you explain that? Because these people came from all over the country. Many of them came on busloads from the Deep South, where they were harassed on the way, which would make me, I'll tell you, angry. So they finally get to Washington. They see hundreds of thousands of people who look like them. You said, Charles, that when you got to the mall, you had never seen so many black people in one place in your life.
Right.
So when you see all of these people who look like you, that's power, my friend. How do you keep a lid on it after years of oppression?
Excuse me. Please appreciate this.
Okay.
We all knew intuitively that this was a church service.
Hmm.
And you go to church with your best Sunday go-to-meeting clothes, and you adapt an attitude of respect and behave the best you can. Keep in mind also that one of the persons that Martin really appreciated and was a part of my learning too.
Martin is Dr. King.
Dr. King, yes. Was Gandhi, who with this quiet notion of satyagraha, you put your body, your spirit in the heart of machinery and stand nonviolently and do not move. And he organized and England, British Empire, had to get out of town. All right? So the power, now if we'd been dumb enough, come on, let's keep this real. If we'd been dumb enough, and I know the brother down in Monroe and Williams, but if we'd been dumb enough to come up here, yeah, I'm the man, I'm packing. Not only would I'd not only not be here at this moment, thank you for all of you, but I wouldn't even be a note in history.
Mm. But the crowd was not all black. There were just
about 25% were white. Yeah.
There were many, many white people and many, many prominent white people in that crowd. And that was the outpouring of aspiration and expectation and goodwill by people from all over the country, from Nebraska, from Minnesota, from Washington State, from as well as from the Deep South. And that sort of was like lighting a match at a tinderbox of goodwill and great hope and expectation.
And I think we have a short-term memory, too. We had the bus boycott there in Montgomery, a peaceful demonstration. We had already the sit-ins, which already proved that we could be peaceful, even in light of the violence that you saw in many of those scenes. But also, we have got to give credit to Bernard Rushton. I mean, we're talking about a gentleman who organized a march and made sure that police and others stayed on the periphery. And so he was more concerned about lunatics coming in trying to start trouble as opposed to the actual marchers themselves. And I think that his organizational skills and placing them on the outside and placing that crowd also at ease, in addition to that church service, actually helped.
But how do you explain the force, the power, the leadership position that Dr. King attained versus Malcolm X? Because later on we would go into the Black Panther movement and there would be violence or there would be a different attitude about how we should get our rights in the black
Brother
community.
Man,
how do you explain Dr. King's
there
success?
There is something in all of us that would like to be the best we can be. Violence does not, with due respects, motivate, accentuate that sense of the higher power. So Martin was able, and we were blessed to reach always, every morning, to speak to the gods of the universe to help us do the best we can. And what the March on Washington did was to show us all the possibility of a higher place in all of us where we could stand and come together. And it was a huge group of people who had been inspired, Jews, Gentiles, Muslims, everybody, to reach for that higher place. And that's why I know, and my grandma used to say, boy, we ain't where we're going yet, but thank God we ain't where we've been.
We tend to think of the civil rights movement today as this monolith, but back then, as you already mentioned, there were several different organizations and several different schools of thought. There was the Congress of Racial Equality Corps, Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and others. And all of these came together with the NAACP on that day to bring their various coalitions to Washington. Whose idea was this?
Don't forget the Urban League, too.
Okay.
Because they actually instituted that notion of jobs in the movement.
Because it was a jobs march. It was a jobs and freedom march,
it was,
correct?
It was A. Philip Randolph's idea. He had A. Philip Randolph was the organizer of the Pullman Porters Union, and he had really moved President Roosevelt to give jobs and hiring, and he proposed the march.
We have to stop. We'll come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and dermatology, laser, and vein specialists of the Carolinas, welcoming Dr. Olson and Dr. Kazari to the practice, providing state-of-the-art skin care to the Charlotte region. Details at carolinaskin.com. And Actors Theater, presenting Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson, a high-octane rock musical that reimagines the nation's seventh president as a rock star maverick, September 12th to October 5th. Details at atc.org. Perhaps you've heard about 3D printing. It's a relatively new technology, but visionaries say this new process promises to be one of the most important technological advances of our time. Think of it as a Star Trek replicator. Tomorrow, we listen back to a conversation we had earlier this summer about 3D printing. That starts at 9.
The U.S. unemployment rate has been trending downward, but most of the job growth has been in the private sector. What a decline in government jobs means for the economy.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded public radio, we're 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Charles Jones, a former professor at Johnson C. Smith University, an attorney, and a man on the mall 50 years ago on this day for the March on Washington. Jack Claiborne was also there, journalist for the Charlotte Observer, and Dr. Patrick Graham joins us, president and CEO of the Urban League Central Carolinas. We talked about those different organizations, the Urban League, Congress of Racial Equality, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the NAACP. They all came together for this March on Washington. What did each of these groups bring, though, to the movement when the movement was in full force? How did they function?
Well, there were various approaches to individual issues. There were various personalities that had extraordinary persuasive powers. But what Snooter Nonviolent Coordinating Committee did was to say to each one, and I was blessed to have met everyone, we appreciate you, we know how we got here, but we now are organizing a movement where all of us, with due respect, are going to be working together. And the individual NAACP, the individual Urban League, the individual is not how we focus this. This is all of God's children. And out of that respect for what we all had brought to the table, it was compelling that everybody be a part. Can you imagine being out in somewhere yelling, screaming, I'm somebody over here, I'm not, shut up, coming inside the movement. I mean, so it would have neutralized anybody.
But you have leaders of these movements. Each leader has its own agenda and their own ego, and they've kind of sublimated to each other. And then Dr. Martin Luther King, of course, emerges as the great among them.
He brings forth that moral force. I mean, he's the moral, at that time, father of that movement. And when you think about individuals like—
Is that how he was seen at the time?
I believe so. Oh, yes. Yeah. No doubt about it. Even young people held that form. And you had also folks like a John Lewis and others in SNCC who were really about galvanizing these young people and ensuring that there was a youthful voice there in the movement. The NAACP, the oldest of the organizations, and with Roy Wilkins having notions of legality and also civil rights. The National Urban League with a Whitney M. Young, a focus on economics, and becomes really one of the architects of the war on poverty. I mean, so all of these types of organizations are bringing actually different talent. And, of course, there's going to be friction, too, when it comes to some of those egos. You know, Roy Wilkins and Martin didn't always see eye to eye. When you have an NAACP at the time who is seen as the first civil rights organization, and then all of a sudden out of this small church, an SCLC is born, and here now you have a new moral leader. Of course, there's going to be some tensions at times.
You know, there were lots of speakers that day on the mall. This went for a long time, and there was entertainment as well, famous people like Mahalia Jackson. But Dr. King made one of the greatest speeches in American history that day. No one knew that he was going to do that. They knew he was a powerful speaker, but they didn't know that the words that he said that day would ring in our ears forever, probably, right down with the Gettysburg Address and the D-Day speech that FDR made. Jack, you were on the mall that day. When you heard him speak and you felt the reaction of the crowd, what were you thinking?
Well, all the speeches were magnificent. They were all polished. Charles said they came in their Sunday best. They came in their Sunday best rhetoric, too. And all of them, A. Philip Randolph, Whitney Young, Walter Reuther, the union, auto workers union leader, all of them were just inspiring. But then Martin Luther King came, and his soaring cadences just lifted the crowd. And you felt a thrill. I felt a thrill. I just felt a shivering inside me as he talked. And I came back to the office at my bureau, and I told my colleagues, I think they just passed the Civil Rights Act this afternoon.
Well, the Civil Rights Act had been stalled in Congress that summer. President Kennedy had put it through, and he was not initially in favor of this march because he thought it would anger Congress and that would kill the Civil Rights Act. But as the gravitas of this movement surged to the forefront before that day, he came down on the side of it. He was not there. Just as President Nixon made only a surreptitious trip to the encampment on the war on poverty. But today, President Obama will be there. President Clinton will be there. President Carter is scheduled to be there. Why wouldn't Kennedy come out?
That was a period where Congress was full of people who had very little sense of respect for all of God's children, particularly those of us who had a little bit of melon in our pocket. And the power of the presidency apparently is so seductive that you don't want to lose control of your own ego. And let me put it that way. I had met Bobby personally when we were going down into voter registration, make sure they sent some federal folks from NASA. But everybody was afraid. No one had seen the... No one knew what was going to happen.
Right.
Kennedy did not want to associate with something that might provoke violence. And there was just great fear that there was going to be a large crowd and there might be people from outside who were opposed to this crowd who would provoke violence. And he just didn't want to be associated with that. He didn't want to lose control of his agenda in Congress. He didn't want the Civil Rights Act introduced because it would jam up everything else that he wanted to accomplish. All the committee chairmanships in the Senate were Southerners,
right,
and would be opposed to this. So being there and associating himself with it was a great risk in his mind. Of course, as soon as it was over, everybody, all the leaders went to the White House, and the president welcomed them and said, "You all did a good job."
Southern Democrats. There was a fear of losing some of that support also within his party. And later Johnson, who signs the bill, says there goes the South.
Right. So, and he was right.
And he is right. And so there was also that fear on Kennedy's part. And we did see that come to fruition, actually.
What were the marchers that day hoping to achieve? 250,000 people on the Mall, speeches all day, covered on live network television, something that was difficult to do in those days. It was not as easy as it is today. There were no satellite trucks, etc. They had to lay cables. They had to bring studio cameras out into the field. That gave it gravitas. That gave it national attention. What were you hoping to achieve that day?
I think we wanted to make a difference totally. I think we wanted to create the energy that pushed the Voter Rights Act, the Public Accommodations Act. We were all – you have to be hopeful when you riding on some church, country roads and people shooting at you or people still lynching you. But we didn't know what – even the most optimistic of us, we didn't know what would be possible. Except we felt if we all came together, and I don't think most of us realized how many of us were coming either. But I think we felt hopeful that this, at this moment, mm-hmm. with this many people of all diversities, would make an impact on the country.
That was the overarching dream, I'm sure.
Yes.
But the actual march, I'm told, wanted to achieve civil rights legislation, the elimination of segregation in public schools, protection for demonstrators against police brutality, which was common, particularly in the Deep South, public works programs to provide jobs, laws prohibiting racial discrimination in public and private hiring, a $2 per hour minimum wage, self-governance for the District of Columbia, which has still does and had then a black majority. Did the march achieve any of those things?
Well, I think that to some extent, you've obviously had some progress. I think that the war on poverty, other things come after that. And so I think that is some immediate short-term victories. I think if we look at today, though, when we look at disparities, the Pew Research Center released this past summer, 2012, that we now have the widest gap in wealth along ethnic lines. And that's when you take your assets, income, minus those liabilities and expenses.
It's worse today than it was in 63.
It is. The average white household, the median wealth is a little over $113,000. For African Americans, just over $5,000. And for Latinos, just over $6,000. So that shows you that there's a lot to be done still, obviously. And I think that there's a lot achieved because you still see that we've progressed in terms of a society and in income and education. But at the same time, we obviously have our own economic issues still.
Let's go back a little bit to that time again. For people who are too young to remember it, who were not alive in 1963.
Includes me.
Includes you. I was there. because one of the phrases that Dr. King used in that speech that day is a phrase that I'm sure you wouldn't hear today, and that is that he hoped that one day the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners could sit down at the table together. We don't talk about slavery anymore. That was still top of mind. There were still people alive whose grandparents had been slaves back then. Talk about that.
My grandfather, Reverend Arthur Augustus Jones, on my father's side, was born a slave in Macon, Georgia, 1848. My grandma on my father's side was sired by her owner. He came home one night from drinking with the boys and stopped in the pantry. And you notice how lighter that I am, all right? I was very much aware of slavery. And it's still a part. I do still talk about it when I'm talking to younger children or anybody. We think we have come from it in many ways, and made it in one way we have, in some ways we have, but it still has a profound impact. People, can you imagine people minding their own business and being snatched up by the slave traders and put in little coals and in boats and brought over here and sold for their lives, working 18, 19 hours a day? With no hope, because if you tried to do anything, you were snatched and lynched. Can you feel the loneliness of a black man?
And what people don't understand is that although slavery had been over in 1963 for just about 100 years, Jim Crow was very much alive. And many of the things that you're talking about, the lynching, the lack of control, the being put in your place, very much alive.
It sets up, slavery sets up still a legacy of a racial hierarchy that in many ways we still abide by today. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what King understood, because the reality is we needed more than just the former slaveholders and slaves to sit at the table, but we also needed some of those whites who were poor, who were used in the slave system. Mm-hmm. We needed them at the table. We now needed also our Latino brothers and sisters, which you saw in the Chicano movement that comes right after. We needed them at the table. He understood that. So I think that he used that as a symbolism of the racial hierarchy, but he meant everyone in between.
John Lewis spoke that day. John Lewis is the only surviving member of the people who spoke that day. He spoke just over the weekend about this. He's a congressman still from Georgia. He circulated his speech that he was going to make that day prior to giving it, and other participants objected to it because they said it was too strong. It called John Kennedy's civil rights bill too little too late, and he asked which side the federal government was on. He toned down the speech, but he did say, for those who have said be patient and wait, we must say patience is a dirty and nasty word. We cannot be patient. We do not want to be free gradually. We want our freedom, and we want it now. We cannot depend on any political party, for the Democrats and the Republicans have betrayed the basic principles of the Declaration of Independence. Wow.
Well, see, the SNCC people who were there, and though I started on the left side about 12 rows, I slowly worked myself around to this Nick crowd that was on the right side, said to John, "We didn't get here by listening to all them old people. With due respect, we love them. But they're not going to get out in front of a crowd in Mississippi, with due respect." And Medgar had been shot 2 or 3 months before that.
Medgar Evers. Yes.
And so we said, "Brother, take it as far artistically, be very clear, but push this now. With due respect, they can't define who you are or who we are." And he looked and smiled and did a pretty good job of saying the same thing, but in a way that was more acceptable.
Go ahead, Jack.
There was a considerable commotion on the around the speaker's stand as speakers compared their notes and what they were going to say. They didn't want to step on each other's lines, and so there was a lot of last-minute rephrasing or revising of scripts. But John Lewis's script brought matters to a sharp conflict, and there were people who said, "If he says all those things, I'm walking out. I'm just not going to be a part of that." And so they did persuade John Lewis to give up some of the language that was in there, but it was not so much the language but the tone of John Lewis's remarks, the way he said it, the fire in him that made him the second most discussed speaker that afternoon.
I read a couple of articles that talked about how the leaders of this day compared notes and were kind of finalizing what they were going to say before they said it, because a lot was in the hanging in the balance there. They had to go out there and make an impression on people. They only got one shot at this. And Dr. Martin Luther King, of course, I think the whole I Have a Dream section of that speech and the whole Let Freedom Ring section of the speech is not in the text.
That's right.
No.
Mahalia Jackson said, "Talk about the dream."
She had heard him make a speech previous, in which he did talk about the dream.
There's an article in the paper this morning, but that's allegedly that part of the speech was made here first in this area.
And then she had heard him make it, and she wanted him to get back to that theme, Martin. Uh-huh. Talk about the dream, Martin. Sitting right to King's right at the speaker's podium, he could hear her say, "Talk about the dream, Martin."
He was like a jazz musician. He was riffing.
Oh, right, right.
He was riffing. This was...
Well, his body language changed, and the look on his face changed about halfway through that speech.
Because if you hear the beginning of the speech, it sounds like a performer speech. "I'm going to talk now and be officious." And when he gets to the end, he's a preacher.
Exactly, yes, right. Yes. Somebody said when he shifted gears, now, folks, we're going to go to church.
That's right. We have to take a break. We're going to come back with Charles Jones, Jack Claiborne, and Dr. Patrick Graham, and we'll add Steve Crump to the mix. Steve is from WBTV. He's on the Mall this morning for the commemorative ceremonies, which begin at noon. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction on East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. And Surgical Specialists of Charlotte, welcoming Dr. Fernandez and Dr. Nguyen. SSC provides a full range of general and specialty surgical care throughout the Charlotte area. And details are at ssclt.com. On the Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. unemployment rate's been trending downward, but most of the job growth has been in the private sector. What a decline in government jobs means for the economy in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. By the way, our live coverage of the commemorative ceremonies on the march of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington begin at noon. We'll also cover the president's speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial between noon and 4 this afternoon.
Carol Lindell, owner of DCI Home Resource in Charlotte, talks about underwriting on WFAE.
It has brought people to our showroom. We had a special remodeling event. We'd sent out thousands of postcards. We had it in magazines, and over half the people that attended said they'd heard about it from WFAE.
For more information, email underwriting at wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, the famous I Have a Dream speech made that day by Dr. Martin Luther King. Charles Jones was there. He is an activist and an attorney and a professor at Johnson C. Smith University. Jack Claiborne, also there, former editorial writer and reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Dr. Patrick Graham, president and CEO of the Urban League of the Central Carolinas. Nancy on Facebook says, my mother was there with our minister, Ted Harris, at the original version of Dr. King's speech. He gave it 9 months before the March on Washington in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Reverend Harris was fired the next week for saying in his sermon that when he looked at the people in Dr. King's congregation, he understood what the faces must have looked like at the Sermon on the Mount. After Reverend Harris was dismissed, Mama never again set foot in St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, nor did I. Well, award-winning documentarian and WBTV reporter Steve Crump has focused his attention many times in the past on American civil rights, and today he's in Washington on the Mall to cover the commemoration of the March on Washington. President Obama will speak from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial later today in a speech the WFAE will cover live. In fact, our special coverage begins at noon, but we're going to bring Steve into the conversation now for just a few minutes to tell us what the atmosphere there is like this morning. Good morning, Steve.
Morning, Mike. I tell you what, you talk about the atmosphere here right now. There is a steady downpour happening in Washington. I'm in the CBS News Bureau between Union Station and the U.S. Capitol, and you can kind of see cars going by with the windshield wipers and all that. But that does not necessarily diminish the spirit of the day, simply because I can see that there have been people heading towards the mall with a number of signs, and one of the signs basically says, we march for integrated schools. Now, over the weekend, you may remember there was another march. In fact, Dr. Graham and I could not get to each other in the crush of people, but you talk about the whole paradigm shift as it relates to what occurred back in 63 when the themes happened to be for jobs, freedom, and peace. And this particular scenario, you had people carrying signs relating to the voter ID bill in North Carolina and even concerns as it related to Trayvon Martin.
So I take it you are not on the Mall. You are actually at the CBS News Bureau.
Staying dry.
Okay, and the Union Station is a considerable, not a considerable, nothing is very far from anything in Washington, but it's not within eyeshot of the Mall. Do you have any idea how many people are there? I suppose you can eavesdrop on the cameras that are posted.
The actual crowd estimates that they're talking about, it will not be as big as right. Saturday, where they had over 100,000, possibly as many as 200,000 this past weekend. And the amazing thing about the weekend rally they had there, there were not enough monitors or speakers for everyone to hear and see what was going on. But as far as unofficial numbers at this point, they're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000. But it's going to be quite a spectacle of a day. I got to see the itinerary a short time ago. And in the 2 to 3 o'clock hour, you're going to have President Clinton speaking. You're going to have Jimmy Carter. He's on the program. And as one of the, shocking revelations in terms of box office success, you're going to have the cast of the movie The Butler, Oprah and Forrest Whitaker, as they're scheduled to be on the program as well.
Saw that movie over the weekend. To me, it reminded me of The Help. It puts everything back into perspective again. You've done lots of documentaries on various aspects or events surrounding the civil rights movement, Steve, from the march across the John Pettus Bridge in Alabama to integration of Charlotte Mecklenburg School. And in the process, you've spoken to a lot of the people who were there participating in and spearheading the movement at the time. Where would they put the 1963 March on Washington on the list of meaningful moments in the movement?
I think it's a watershed moment, Mike, but the other thing is I was listening to you guys in the previous segments, and I'm sure that Charles Jones can relate to this, is the fact that, and I go back to being here 10 years ago, and one of the most profound things that came out of John Lewis's mouth, where he basically said, he talked about this whole supporting network of folks came together on that day 50 years ago. And the line that I remember him saying, you know, we didn't have a fax machine, we didn't have a website, we didn't have an internet or email, we just put our bodies in the way, and that's how we got there.
Steve Crump joining us from Washington, D.C., where he will be covering the goings-on on the Mall today, and you can see his reports later today on WBTV Channel 3. Thank you for the time, Steve. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Stay dry.
That's you, bro.
Yeah, the Urban League of the Central Carolinas is also doing something today at 6 o'clock, as I said at the very beginning of the show, a day of opportunity on this anniversary of the march. You're releasing an at-opportunity policy agenda. What will that agenda include? What does that mean?
It actually includes policy recommendations based on economics, particularly around jobs. We have a movement called Jobs Rebuild North Carolina. But it also focuses on education. One of the things that's proposed in there, for example, is that we want the legislature to come up with a five-year plan to get us from being 46th in the nation in investment per capita per student to the top 20%, especially since we have one of the greatest college systems in our nation. So it seems that K-12 education, you would need a great feeder system. But the other is also addressing issues such as voting rights, which at this day and age, after the Supreme Court decision to really cut Section 4 of the Act, and then now to see what has happened
in
North
Carolina. That's where states who are historically not in favor of equal rights for voters had to ask the Justice Department for permission to change their laws. Now they no longer do. And that's what led to some of these southern states to be able to change their voter laws, such as North Carolina. Do you feel like you are having to fight the battles of the civil rights movement all over again?
I think without a doubt that you do see that occurring. I mean, we've always had to fight those. I mean, if you think about the disparities I mentioned earlier in terms of income, other things, and if you look at even now our cuts in unemployment insurance, for example, for those who are unemployed, these are all issues that King fought for. As a matter of fact, in Look magazine in 1968, shortly before he dies, he says, you really can consider this movement a movement about jobs and income. And again, voting, other things also play a part in that. And so I think there's no doubt that we're still fighting many of those issues.
Jack, you're a grizzled old newsman. Compare what's going on today and the fight that Dr. Graham has just referred to what was going on in
1960. Well, I'd see an effort to roll back some of the accomplishments of the civil rights movement, especially in the suppression of the vote. And if the opponents of the minority voting are successful, you can expect them to roll back achievements in other areas as well.
And what's the agenda here? What's the real reason?
Well, the real reason is that they want to manage the politics of the country.
So it's not racial; it's political.
It is
because
political.
One
absolutely
because the,
yes,
they're more likely to vote Democratic.
That's right. The effort is
so
a
we're sacrificing,
partisan.
We're it's sacrificing a, rights on the altar of politics.
I think it is sacrificing the country on the altar of politics. Yeah, I thought the thing that the March on Washington did was tell all the people in the country that we're all in this together. And now the effort to suppress the vote is to tear it apart minority group by minority group.
One thing that that those of us who lived through the 1960s have in our DNA is the passion and the turmoil of that period, civil rights, Vietnam, young people coming to the fore, sexual liberation, the women's movement, etc. Today, you don't see much of that. People are kind of into their iPads and their iPhones and their MTV or whatever the heck they're watching on television now, and they don't seem to get upset by these things like they used to.
I think, though, that you're seeing a change in that, and I really take a lot of people to task with that, because if I think about even what we're doing today, this day of opportunity, there are 60 people on that planning committee. The average age is 30 years old. Mm-hmm. When I think about the second March on Washington I just attended this past Saturday, it was the youth speakers that really rallied the crowd the most. And even back at that time, when you talk about the civil rights movement and you're talking about 1963, it was people like those in SNCC who really galvanized people. So I think that when we look at technology as well, I mean, Egypt just fell, starting on Facebook, young people. I think that many of them march, but they march in a different way, and we have to tap into that, particularly through technology.
You know, people thought and hoped that President Obama's election, first election, was an indication that we'd moved into a post-racial America, and it's turned out probably to be kind of the opposite, that he's become a beacon of he's been put up as It's contentious because he's black. Let's put it that way. Where are we in terms of race relations today in America?
Let me, as an optimist.
And I have about a minute.
Mm-hmm. As an optimist who's seen change, mm-hmm. say to all you young people, this little period of time where these little minority group of people grabbing power is going to last that long. That's going to be those of us, all of us, go stand up and say, wait a minute, sit your behind down. We're going to continue to build the beloved community. And you are so infinitely small part of it. Sit your behind down and let the rest of the people of this country do the right thing. All right?
I agree totally. I think this is a temporary hiccup. And it's really, you can't postpone the inevitable. We have changing demographics, but we have a changing view, particularly in our younger generation, on these matters. Mm-hmm. And they don't view the world always through the prism of race, ethnicity. And the largest growing group, statistically, is multiracial people. So we are getting there. I think that this is the last sort of round for a generation whose time has passed. And what we have to do is protect ourselves enough that they don't do so much damage that it takes us so long to dig out of it.
Let the church say amen.
Amen.
Amen. Okay. Dr. Patrick Graham, Charles Jones, Jack Claiborne, thank you very much for the hour today. Information about this afternoon's local commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington can be found on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. By the way, it's at the Park Ministry, 6029 Beatty's Ford Road. And WFAE's special coverage of the national commemoration in Washington begins at noon today. Let's close this hour with the trademark sounds and words of the civil rights movement of the 60s.
We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. Now, before this victory's won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Before the victory's won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators, but we shall overcome. And I'll tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday.
This nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream.
That we shall overcome someday.
I have a dream that my poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing.
land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims cried, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the crevaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty.